It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station. We're broadcasting from up here on beautiful Signal Hill, where it's 30 degrees. 32 degrees out at the airport, where they have winds from the west at 12, gusting to 16 miles per hour. We're looking for mostly sunny skies today with a high near 35. Northwest winds turning to the southwest this afternoon, which is going to bring us a 50% chance of snow after 3 a.m. tonight. Coming up on the Midday Report, the U.S. Secretary of Commerce has approved disaster designations for over a dozen fisheries in Alaska. The Kodiak Emergency Operations Center has reported just 54 new cases of COVID since its last announcement. And the Board of Fish is thinking again on where and when to have its Southeast meeting. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Joe Biden is holding out hope that diplomacy will be enough to de-escalate a confrontation intensifying in Eastern Europe. He says he has no intention of putting U.S. forces in Ukraine while Russian forces are building up outside its borders. But the Pentagon's placing thousands of troops on heightened alert to support NATO just in case Russian President Vladimir Putin were to breach Ukraine's border.
There will be enormous consequences if he were to go in and invade, as he could, the entire country, or a lot less than that as well, for Russia, not only in terms of economic consequences and political consequences, but it will be enormous consequences worldwide. This would be the largest, if he were to move in with all those forces, would be the largest invasion since World War II.
However, Moscow accuses the West of fueling panic. Russian state media have been reinforcing that message in their reporting of the standoff. NPR's Greg Myrie reports the U.S. does not think President Vladimir Putin has yet made a decision on whether to invade.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby described the Russian buildup as steady and ongoing.
We continue to see additional combat forces, Russian combat forces, move into the western part of their country, around the border with Ukraine and into Belarus. And again, that remains deeply concerning to us.
Those forces include ground troops, artillery, armored vehicles, and air power. But Kirby went on to say,
we still don't believe that Mr. Putin has made a final decision.
The U.S. military has put 8,500 troops on high alert for possible deployment in NATO countries in Eastern Europe. The Pentagon says it's actively making preparations, but no troops are currently on the move. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
General Motors says it will invest $7 billion in Michigan plants, most of it dedicated to electric vehicles. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports this is just the latest in a string of such announcements from major automakers.
GM says this will be the largest single investment in the company's history. It's building a new battery cell plant and converting an existing production plant to electric pickups. GM CEO Mary Barra says by 2025, GM will have the capacity to build 1 million electric vehicles, also called EVs, every year.
Now, we have said we aim to be the market leader in EVs by mid-decade, and today's news is a big step forward to achieving that goal.
The current market leader is Tesla, but major automakers are racing to catch up. Ford recently announced it's planning to nearly double its production of the electric F-150 Lightning. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
The Dow closes down nearly 67 points. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
The Kodiak Emergency Operations Center has reported 54 new cases of COVID-19 for the Kodiak Island borough since its last announcement on Friday. There are currently 388 cases classified as active locally, and there are two active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. To date, in the Kodiak Island Borough, there have been 4,284 cases, 110 local hospitalizations, and 9 deaths associated with COVID-19. The U.S. Secretary of Commerce approved disaster designations for over a dozen fisheries in Alaska. As KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports, it's the second time in the last 5 years that the Gulf of Alaska's cod fishery has been deemed a disaster by the federal government.
The latest disaster determination for the Gulf of Alaska's cod fishery is for the year 2020. The federal cod fishery was also closed that year, and the state's fishery stock was only a fraction of years past. To put it in perspective, state's fisheries biologist Nat Nichols gives some figures.
2017 in Kodiak, the cod quota was 12.2 million pounds.
He says that by 2020, the state cod quota had dropped to just 1.5 million pounds. The last time the Gulf of Alaska's cod fishery was given disaster status was back in 2018. In its latest list of disaster declarations, the Federal Commerce Department cited salmon fisheries from the Yukon River to Prince William Sound and the Eastern Bering Sea Tanner crab fishery. Most of the designations are for the year 2020. Carla Bush is a program manager with Fish and Game. She says it's unusual to see so many fishery disaster declarations in such a short time span.
And I think that was in response just to some of the unprecedented high temperatures that we saw both in the Gulf of Alaska and in the Bering Sea from about 2016-17 through 2018.
Once approved, it's up to Congress to decide if affected fishermen will receive payouts, and that can take time. Bush notes that funding for 2018's cod fishery disaster designation in the Gulf of Alaska has just started going out to skippers and crew who suffered losses. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Alaska's Board of Fisheries is considering moving its Southeast meeting back to Ketchikan, and it's asking the public to weigh in. The board, which sets the state's subsistence, commercial, and sport fishing rules, plans to discuss more than 150 proposed changes to the Southeast Alaska finfish and shellfish regulations at the meeting, which was originally slated to be held in Ketchikan this month, but was postponed due to a rise in COVID-19 cases in the region. The meeting was then moved to Anchorage and pushed back 2 months to early March. That ignited a firestorm of criticism from fishermen and subsistence harvesters, who said they were concerned their input would not be adequately heard. Some also pointed out that the postponed meeting could cut into commercial and subsistence harvesting seasons in Southeast. But now the Board of Fish says it's mulling a do-over for the meeting's location. In a statement released on Monday, Board of Fish Executive Director Glenn Haight wrote that Ketchikan Representative Dan Ortiz, who represents Southeast Alaska, worked with the city of Ketchikan to make the Ted Ferry Civic Center available in March. Southeast Alaska's Board of Fish meeting usually runs for 13 days, but the Ted Ferry Civic Center was only available for 11 days. If the meeting is moved back to Ketchikan, some of the 153 proposals set to be considered might need to be tabled until a statewide meeting of the board later in the spring. A COVID-19 vaccine requirement for travelers entering Canada took effect in mid-January, and it's raising concern from the trucking industry that it will disrupt the flow of goods to Alaska. Two Alaska lawmakers tried to raise the issue to the Canadian Prime Minister last week, but as Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, it's not clear how much of an effect it will have on the Alaska consumer.
Clyde Carey, the owner of the trucking company 49th Freight, says when the vaccine requirement went into effect on January 15th, he saw an immediate effect.
Just a rough number would be I'm down to a third of the pool of drivers that I was using.
49th Freight mostly contracts with operators who own their own trucks. The company will request those truckers take a load of freight, some of which requires specialized skills or equipment. Carey says since the 15th, he's gone from about 40 drivers to 10 or 15. The law of supply and demand means he just has one option to keep the freight moving. He has to pay drivers more.
So that price is just shooting up. And if a truckload requires more and more specialized skill set or endorsements, it just goes up from there.
About 40% of truckers in the U.S. aren't vaccinated for COVID, according to the American Trucking Association. Joe Michel leads the Alaska Trucking Association, an affiliate of the National Group. He says truck drivers pose little risk to the communities they pass through.
I don't want to say the sky's falling. It's just an extreme inconvenience for no good reason. These truckers are staying in their trucks. I mean, they're working by themselves. Out of all the different, you know, ways to put hiccups in the supply chain, this just seems like a real silly one.
The issue has caught attention of some Alaska lawmakers, like Wasilla Republican Shelley Hughes. She penned a letter to the White House and to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau calling for an immediate end to the requirement. Trudeau has held firm, though, arguing that vaccine mandates keep drivers working by preventing sickness and death. Senator Hughes doesn't buy that argument.
I think any justification for the mandates continuing, the impacts that are going to have on critical, essential commodities and products that we need is worse than what, you know, what the vaccine might do. In fact, not being able to have fresh, healthy produce, I mean, that's actually a health impact.
But the practical effect of the mandate is yet to be seen. Empty shelves in Alaska stores largely preceded the mandate going into effect, and only a small percentage of produce is shipped in on the highway system, says Darren Prokop, a logistics professor at UAA.
We do know that the vast majority of consumables entering Alaska come into the port of Alaska via the port of Tacoma. So it doesn't have to enter Canadian space, in this case, Canadian waters. So it's a trickle, but nonetheless, it's still significant.
Shipping companies keep the breakdowns of the type of freight they're hauling under wraps, so it's not clear how much of an effect the loss of truckers will have on grocery shelves. Prokop says the bigger effect might be on industries like oil and gas, which rely on truckers to get equipment into the state that doesn't fit in containers that barges ship. Still, he says any bottleneck in shipping will have an effect on Alaskans one way or another.
The bottom line is if you have less ability to move things, it is going to raise costs of these final goods as far as consumers are concerned.
He says it's too early, though, to know by how much. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Lex Trinan.
Ketchikan officials are cracking down on camping in some public parking lots inside city limits. Heightened penalties for illegal camping are also set to take effect next month. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, that's after the city council passed a measure that also allows officials to clear encampments.
Ketchikan officials are cracking down on camping in some public parking lots inside city limits. Heightened penalties for illegal camping are set to take effect next month. That's after the city council passed a measure that also allows officials to clear encampments. City officials cited complaints from downtown residents about noise, theft, and drug use at an Edmund Street parking lot just a block away from Ketchikan's police station as the impetus for a measure that strengthens an existing ban on overnight camping in city-owned parking lots. At a meeting last October, Sylvia Gruder said she called police to report drug activity and other nuisances in the lot.
We have homeless people living in the parking lot. We have drug interactions going on in broad daylight. He said, there is nothing that can be done.
Gruder recalled that the police officer suggested their hands were tied.
I said, what's left? What can I do? And he said, you can go down to City Hall and get an ordinance put in place.
And that's what happened at the City Council's most recent meeting. Ryan McHale was the lone voice opposing the new measure. The Ketchikan resident said the City Council should instead expand funding for organizations that support the community's unhoused people.
Strengthening the city's ban on camping in city-owned parking lots is the wrong approach. Forced removal, possible destruction of personal property, and increased fines do not resolve the underlying conditions that create the need for camping in the first place, and serve only to take away resources for those already living on the edge.
He asked the council to reduce the fine by two-thirds, which would max out to $100, and strike portions of the measure that would allow the city to confiscate tents, bedding, medication, and food with 72 hours notice. They'd be held by the city for up to 3 months. But the ordinance passed as written. Supporters included Councilmember Ryan Lee Gass. He said that organizations like the Park Avenue Temporary Home and First City Homeless Services provide plenty of beds for people in need of shelter to sleep.
So I think the community has gone far enough to provide somewhere for people to go who don't have a place to go. If that weren't the case, I wouldn't be in support of this. But quite frankly, if someone is homeless, it doesn't mean they have a right to do these negative things in public areas.
Each day of illegal camping would incur an infraction. That's a minor offense like a traffic ticket, which would come with a fine of up to $300. Councilmember Lalette Kistler said she hoped judges would stop short of imposing the maximum fine, but she still supported the measure, which passed unanimously. It's slated to take effect on February 19th. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
State regulators doubled down last Thursday on their refusal to investigate a 2016 fuel gas leak in Cook Inlet, capping a years-long disagreement with a former commissioner over the scope of the agency's authority. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is charged with protecting the environment and preventing waste in the oil industry, and the kerfuffle over the 2016 leak hinges on one of those words, waste. The State Commission says the Hillcore leak didn't count as waste because the gas from Nikiski to the platform that escaped was on the other side of the meter from where it was produced, meaning it belonged to Hillcorp and was no longer up to the state to regulate. But former Commissioner Hollis French took a different view. French, who also served as a Democratic state senator from Anchorage, was on the commission at the time of the leak. And after Governor Mike Dunleavy fired him from the agency in 2019, he petitioned commissioners to take a deeper look into the matter.
Gas shot up into the air for several months. That gas was wasted. What happened because the gas was wasted? The oil platform shut down and oil production was lost.
The commission refused and French sued. The Supreme Court of Alaska sided with him, saying the commission needed evidence to back up its decision not to investigate. But the commission remains unmoved and will not investigate or fine Hillcorp for the leak. In a decision published on Thursday, commissioners took the same stance as they did in 2019. In a three-page order, they said the state regulators are concerned an expanded definition of a leak would open up a Pandora's box, expanding the commission's authority over cases like Exxon Valdez and a rupture in an NSTAR natural gas line. A spokesperson for the commission declined further comment. French says he's not surprised, but he finds the decision lazy. Waste is waste, he says, no matter where it occurs, near the source or during distribution.
The meter is not the point. getting the gas in the oil to the meter is exactly half the job. The other half is delivering it to some person who wants to make good use of it.
French could appeal the decision with the commission or in court. He says he's still pondering his options. Hillcorp's pipeline was first installed in 1965 and carried fuel gas made up mostly of methane. Investigators say that a rock on the ocean floor caused the 2016 leak. The ruptured Hillcorp line released an estimated 210,000 to 310,000 cubic feet of gas each day, enough to power more than 1,000 homes for a day. It leaked for 3 months before Hillcorp patched it, citing danger from sea ice. The line has a history of leaks dating back to 2014. Its most recent reported leak was last spring. Following that leak, federal regulators ordered Hillcorp to replace the gas line. Fairbanks can expect job growth in the next year, according to a report from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. KUAC's Mary Ald has this report.
Labor Department economist Sarah Teal forecast the Fairbanks job market will add about 1,000 jobs in 2022. She says an increase in population related to the new F-35A fighter jet squadrons at Eielson Air Force Base will continue to expand the number of jobs in Fairbanks. According to Teal, population growth will make the Fairbanks job market strong compared to other parts of the state, where population is decreasing.
When we have more people coming into the community, they will be spending more money. And that money will then spur growth in whatever industries that they are spending in. So normally we would see this in things like restaurants and bars or supermarkets or car lots.
Teal developed these projections using specialized computer programs, but they're not set in stone. Changes in the pandemic or other unexpected events could cause deviations from these projections.
We've had to take in a lot of information about what is going on. And then there's like with every day that we wake up, there is something different.
Teal predicts jobs will grow as the COVID-19 pandemic eases. According to the report, Fairbanks will recover 1,500 of the 2,500 jobs it lost at the beginning of the pandemic by the end of 2022. Most of those jobs will be related to tourism or transportation of goods, sectors that were hit hard by pandemic shutdowns. For KUAC, I'm Mary Ald.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
It is interesting to note that back when men wore hats, it was considered subversive not to wear hats. Now it's the people that wear hats that give the impression that they're going against the grain. For men, I've heard it was because of President John F. Kennedy. He didn't like wearing hats and he had great hair, so men stopped wearing hats. Yet the book Hatless Jack states that contrary to widespread opinion, hat wearing was already in decline and had been since the 1920s. Also, compared to the 19th century, buildings were better heated and people spent less time out of doors. Before the Stetson, ranchers and cowboys wore whatever hats they had on hand, from top hats to sailor caps. During a hunting trip in the late 1850s, John B. Stetson made himself a hat with what he considered to be a comically large brim, but soon realized that it was big enough to keep the sun and rain off his head and neck. 15 years later, in 1865, Stetson decided to start making the hats professionally, and 20 years later, the company employed more than 1,100 people. The 1882 play Fedora, with Sarah Bernhardt as Princess Fedora, a European royal who wore the now familiar soft felt hat with a narrow brim, a crease on the top, and a pinch on each side, became the everyday hat of the 20th century. Mad as a Hatter. The mercury used in the preparation of felt for hats led to the apparent symptoms of lunacy in many 19th century hatters, hence the expression, mad as a hatter. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 25th day of January, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 9:25. It will set again at 5:19. That will give us 7 hours and 54 minutes of daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 4 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this date was -3, set in 1947, and our record high was 50 degrees, set in 1950. Currently 30 degrees here at the station. Mostly sunny skies are called for today, high near 35. 50% chance of snow after 3 a.m. tonight. Cloudy skies tonight with a low of 27. And look for some snow tomorrow, too, mainly after 9 a.m., high near 35 tomorrow with north winds to 20. New snow accumulation of up to 2 inches is possible tomorrow, and we're looking for more snow tomorrow night as well. But don't worry, it's going to turn to rain and snow on Thursday. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming right up here at 1:23 this afternoon. That will be a 1.7-foot tide here on the east side. Our next high tide will be at 7:20 p.m. and be at 5.7 feet, followed by a low tide at 12:56 a.m. of 2.4 feet. And our high tide for tomorrow morning here on the east side will be at 7:39 a.m. and be 8.6 feet. Over on the west side, you have a low tide coming up at 1:54 p.m., a 2.5 foot tide in Larsen Bay. That will be followed by a high tide at 7:54 p.m. of 10.2 feet. Your next low tide will be at 1:35 a.m. and be 3.8 feet. And your high tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will be at 8:11 a.m. and be 13.5 feet in Larsen Bay. Mariners, be aware, we have a gale warning for Wednesday from Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side. For today, west 20, seas to 12. For tonight, variable 10, becoming northeast 25 after midnight, seas to 8 feet. And for tomorrow, northeast 35, seas to 10 feet on our east side. In the Shelikof Strait, gale warning for Wednesday as well. Southwest 25 today, diminishing to variable 15 in the afternoon. Seas to 8 feet, subsiding to 5 feet in the afternoon, but look for freezing spray in the Shelikof today. For tonight, north 20 and seas to 5 feet, and for tomorrow in the Shelikof, northeast 25, increasing to 35 tomorrow afternoon, seas building to 11 feet tomorrow afternoon, and for Wednesday night in the Shelikof, northeast 40, seas to 13 feet. The Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center will be having their regular monthly meeting of the Board of Directors at 6 p.m. tonight. Guests are welcome. Call 486-6171 or email them at contact@kwrcc.org for more information on how to attend. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session tonight. That meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. and be conducted virtually. They will also be having a regular meeting on Thursday night. That meeting will also be at 7:30 p.m. and also be virtual. Public participation for both meetings is virtual only. Public members are encouraged to tune in right here at KMXT on 100.1 FM. The meeting will also be web streamed, and the web streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. If you have more questions, please contact the city clerk at 486-8636. The Solid Waste Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting on Wednesday. That's tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. It will be virtual as well. And on Thursday, the Borough Assembly will be having a work session, also at 6:30 p.m. and also virtual. Tune in the meetings online at www.kodiakak.us. That's the Kodiak Island Borough website. For questions, call the Borough Clerk's office at 907-486-9310. The Coast Guard Marine Safety Detachment here in Kodiak reminds you to check the date of your commercial fishing vessel safety decal in the window. If it is expiring soon or has expired, stop by their office downtown and pick up a checklist to prepare for your dockside exam. A safety exam is required for all commercial fishing vessels that operate more than 3 miles from shore, including transiting to the fishing area. You can contact them at 907-486-5918 or stop by their office in the subway building if you have any questions. Three seats are open on the Board of Directors of the Kodiak Electric Association. The Board of Directors consists of 9 elected voting directors and 1 United States Coast Guard appointed non-voting liaison. This year, the seats currently held by directors Linda Freed, Jay Johnston, and Matt Moyer are all up for election. All 3 seats are for 3-year terms. KEA members locally elect KEA directors. Candidate petition packets are available by contacting the KEA office. To be an eligible candidate, you must be a member of KEA. Completed candidate petition packets must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, March 16th at the KEA office. That's at 1614 Mill Bay Road. For further information or to request a candidate petition packet, contact Nancy Sweeney at 486-7700. Do you know a teen or youth group doing something specially positive in your community? You can nominate them for a Spirit of Youth recognition. All nominees are publicly recognized in their communities. Research demonstrates that youth who are recognized for their accomplishments are better able to build confidence in their future. Youth and or youth groups will be selected in the early spring to receive Spirit of Youth Awards. We rely on community members like you to let youth know they matter. It takes only 10 minutes to nominate someone online. You just need to go to spiritofyouth.org to find the nomination form. A housing needs assessment survey is coming soon to Kodiak. Help your community by participating in the survey, which may come by mail or via a phone call. Responses are anonymous and will be incorporated into a housing needs assessment document that will be available to the public. Those who complete the survey will be entered into a prize drawing happening each week in February. This message is sponsored by the Kodiak Island Housing Authority.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org. Thank you.